Hello, hello, and welcome to this episode of Her Music Academia, the podcast. I'm your host, Lydia Bangura. On this podcast, we're talking music, we're talking scholarship, we're talking pedagogy. I research classical music as a music PhD student at the University of Michigan. I'm also an active performer, I'm an opera singer, and I love art song. And on the show, I feature a whole host of interviews with other musicians, other music scholars, composers, conductors, and we talk all about what they do in music. Today on the show, I have a conversation with Dr. Owen Belcher from the University of Missouri, Kansas City, Dr. Katrina Kim, and Dr. Alan Reese, who are both at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. We chat all about their musical upbringings and music. We talk about how they all met at Eastman in grad school. And we chat all about their Music Theory Online article that just came out in the most recent issue, titled Public Music Theory's Neoliberal Learning Outcomes. Make sure you click the link in the show notes to read their article. This episode is actually going to be part one of our conversation. Since it got a little lengthy, I split it into two different episodes. So in this first part, we're just going to be talking about their backgrounds, their time in grad school, and advice that they would give to current music grad students. Stay tuned for part two, where we dive into the article. Without further ado, here's our conversation. All right, hello everyone, and welcome to this very special episode of the podcast. It's truly a music theory extravaganza that's happening today with the most amount of guests that I've ever had on the show. So I'm really, really excited that we could work out a recording between the four of us. Today we're going to dive into their recent MTO article, get into their personal histories with music and all of that stuff. So today on the show we have Katrina Kim, Alan Reese, and Owen Belcher. Welcome to the show, everyone.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks. I'm so excited to hear more about your work and maybe what's to come from your work, all of that stuff. I normally start off the show by talking about how I come to be introduced with a guest or their work. This is actually, I think, my first time meeting all of you, or unless I'm horribly forgetting if I shook your hand at a conference or something.
Yeah, I don't have any memory, but I... very forgetful, so I don't know.
Yeah, so this is an instance in which Dr. Steve Rogers sent me your MTO article. I probably would have seen it eventually in checking out the current issue of Music Theory Online, but he specifically sent it to me because I am this year participating in the Public Music Theory plenary session for this podcast. And so, you know, he was like, you might want to check this out beforehand, because I'm sure it will come up in the conversation and in the Q&A and stuff. So I was really, really happy to encounter it. Shout out to Steve Rogers. And I'm excited to hear more about your thoughts today and more about the response and all of that stuff. So let's go ahead and dive in and start with a bit about all of your backgrounds in music. So how about we'll start with Katrina, and if you could kind of start with your own personal interactions with music as a kid. So kind of where you're from and the music that was happening in the place where you're from, if you're from a musical family and when you first started formally or informally interacting with music, singing, playing, writing, any of that.
Yeah, sure. And I want to echo Alan and say thank you so much for inviting us on the podcast. It's really cool to be a part of this, and I've never done this before, so I'm a little nervous.
Oh, don't be.
Well, in terms of my musical upbringing, there are no professional musicians in my family, and so that's not really something that it was never really something I thought of as kind of like an option, you know, as a career. But my dad was and is an amateur musician. So he played the guitar and he played the piano a little bit and sang pretty regularly. So I grew up hearing some of that. We also grew up I grew up, my sisters and I, in church. And so a lot of, like, that's probably one of the main sources of music, going every week, sometimes multiple times a week. And there was always a lot of music, like through congregational singing or like small group sort of singing, sometimes being asked to play piano or flute as well. It's something I took up a little bit later to when I joined band in fourth grade. And I also took piano lessons. So my mom took piano lessons as a kid, and she was really insistent that my siblings and I, we all take some form of music lessons. And I think for her, taking piano lessons represented discipline and hard work. And I think for her, those were really important values. And she talked about that a lot at home. And I think that's not uncommon among immigrant families. But in addition to those values, I think she thought of skill in music as also being a possible lifelong activity and a possible source of like lifelong joy and passion. So I think she just wanted that for us. So my sister and I, we started taking piano lessons from a guitarist at a local music shop when I was 4 and she was 6. So that's kind of my musical introduction. As a kid.
Okay. And so did you, I'm just going to stick with each of you individually. When did you decide that maybe this is something that you wanted to do professionally?
Sure. Yeah. So I had this plan when I was in high school that I was going to go to law school. Ooh. So I did this research project. Yeah. I did this research project at a legal clinic in downtown Chicago, which is the area I'm from, like the Chicagoland suburbia, that kind of region. Mm-hmm. So I was really interested in going to law school, and my plan was to major and go to college and major in political science. And I'd already applied to a few colleges at this point with that, like, as checked off as my intended major. But my advisor for this research project, and she was a lawyer, she specialized in defending Mexican nationals who were sentenced to death in the United States for crimes that they had committed, usually in the United States across the border. She basically told me that I should major in music instead, because once I went to law school and I started my career, I would never ever have that kind of opportunity to really focus and on anything other than my career until maybe retirement. So that kind of stuck in my head for a little bit. And I ended up applying to 2 more colleges and then did my auditions in addition to the normal application. And I ended up going to college, majoring in piano performance, the University of Houston. So that's it, you know, that's only the beginning of the story, because I was still planning to go to law school.
Oh, wow.
And so, yeah, I was just thinking, okay, well, I'll just major in piano, but I mean, you can major in anything if you're going to go to law school. You just need to take the LSAT. At least, I don't know if that's still true. I'm not really up to date with law school admissions. But that's what I understand. So I was fully planning to do that until my junior year of college, when my undergraduate thesis advisor, she was a political theorist. She mentioned the possibility of studying political theory in grad school and as a career. And this is the first time I'd entertained the idea of academia. I started reading more scholarship in political science, but as a piano major, a performance degree is very all-encompassing in terms of the amount of real estate it takes in a degree plan. So that was really what occupied so much of my brain all the time and my body. So I ended up reading a little bit about in music academia. I took some upper-level electives in music theory and musicology, and I was really attracted to music analysis specifically because of the way it engaged me aurally and also physically, but also discursively. So it just kind of like brought together a lot of things that I loved. And that's what kind of convinced me to go the music theory route. So then I ended up applying to a few programs, went to Eastman, and that's where I met both Alan and Owen.
Oh, great. I was going to get to that. Wonderful. Okay. Well, thank you so much for sharing all of that. So let's go ahead and go to Owen then and hear a bit more about your musical background, where you're from, the music that was happening in the place where you're from, if you're from a musical family, all of that.
Sure, and let me just now belatedly echo both Alan and Katrina and say thank you for having us
Thank
on your
you.
podcast. This is also my first time, and I'm
Wonderful.
also very nervous, so we'll see
Please
how it
don't.
goes.
I mean, you saw the way that I grilled Katrina, so
I
please be
know,
ready.
but she spoke so eloquently, and I,
Well, you said you didn't want to go first,
Oh, I
so.
know, and so I'm second, and so I appreciate you fulfilling the letter of the law there. So the first music I really remember was also like Katrina in church, but it was organ music. So I went to a church that had a traditional pipe organ, and I just thought this was the coolest thing I had ever heard. The organist there, Andre Lash, actually taught at UNCG for quite a while before finally retiring. But he would let me play after the church services, and I just really loved making these sounds with, it was like three pianos stacked on top of each other, and there were all these buttons I couldn't reach with my feet, and it just seemed like the coolest thing. And I started violin lessons with the Suzuki method really young because my best friend. And it was really because my parents were best friends with her parents, but she was playing violin and I wanted to be like her. So I started Suzuki violin lessons. And so that was kind of my earliest musical experiences. There were no professional musicians in my immediate family, though my mother is an excellent amateur jazz pianist and will play for various kind of social gatherings. She would play and sing in bars to kind of make some extra money on the side and stuff. So she's very good with the kind of the Great American Songbook repertoire and also jazz improv. Certainly a much better pianist than I am. My uncle was a pianist and was actually a college professor as a pianist, but he's probably one of my favorite and most influential relatives, but I didn't see him very often, so I'm not sure how much that played a role really in choosing to pursue music. But I joined the orchestra in elementary school when I could, and I my intention was to be a violinist, and I can't really remember when that started. I think I knew I wanted to be a violinist and a teacher, maybe just because the adults that were not family members that I came into contact most were teachers. So that's kind of who modeled adulthood to me, just from school and everything. And so I went to Furman University, which is a small liberal arts college in Greenville, South Carolina. And I grew up in the Carolinas, which is why I sound like this.
We were all thinking
Yeah, it's all right. Yeah, I'm from
it.
North Carolina, and my intention was to major in violin, but I really, as much as I enjoyed playing the violin, I really just couldn't make myself spend 6 hours in a practice room alone for, frankly, like a mediocre product. I mean, I was okay, but I mean, it was not going to be great. So my violin teacher and I was really interested in music theory, and my violin teacher and I came to the conclusion that maybe a switch to theory might be in my best interests, and I'm glad I made that decision because I certainly had much more fun studying and analyzing and listening than I would have playing, more quoits or etudes or something in a small room. And so I wound up with a theory degree, which at Furman was also very flexible because you could take a lot more liberal arts classes and kind of take advantage of the liberal arts offering. So I was really interested in history and German
So,
and
did
the.
you do a theory undergrad at
I
Furman?
did, yes. I did a
Oh,
theory
wow, cool.
undergrad. So yeah, I had the Kool-Aid from the beginning. But it really freed up electives. So that was a good side benefit, because I got to take some really interesting non-musical courses that otherwise I wouldn't have been able to take. Mm. And then for my master's degree, it was, I was kind of torn between doing conducting and theory, but I wound up at the University of Cincinnati with doing music theory, and then at Eastman, and that's where I met my partners in crime here. And we were in the same cohort, and we braved those winters together.
Okay, great. I can't wait to hear all about the crime. We're going to get into it. All right. So let's transition to Alan and hear more about your musical background, history, family, all that stuff.
So I did actually come from a musical family. My father was a saxophonist, and he mostly plays jazz at this point, but kind of grew up as one of the five classical saxophonists in, you know, mid-60s America, before it's exploded into 10, I don't know. Anyway, he also does composition, and he teaches, or he's now retired, but he used to teach at the small public university in Savannah, Georgia, where I'm from. And at that university, he would kind of teach really anything just because of the size of the school. So he would, you know, teach some saxophonists, but also clarinetists, but also jazz band, music theory classes, music appreciation classes. So I had a lot of exposure to not only different kinds of music and going to all the different school concerts and stuff, but also to the idea of being in music academia of some kind. I mean, he was more on the performance side of things, but still some exposure to that world. And then also my mother played piano when she was in, you know, middle school, high school that time. So she still, you know, could play some. And then my brother also went into music for his undergrad and master's in classical saxophone before he, you know, wised up and became a librarian, which is a very smart call.
That's where the money is.
That's right.
Library science, I'm coming.
But anyway, so everybody was doing some kind of music or had done some kind of music growing up. In terms of the kinds of music I was exposed to, it was a lot of, you know, college concerts, as I said before, or my dad was ran this Savannah Jazz Orchestra, so going to a lot of the jazz concerts there. And then I started playing piano around age 8 or so. And I think parents both played instruments, and because they were both, especially my mother, pressured to play their instrument as a kid all the time, they were pretty hands-off in terms of not wanting to pressure either of us. But I guess through soft power, we ended up doing it anyway. And I think there was a piano in the house, and I just liked hitting it. It was also right next to the computer. So it was a good way of getting people off of it if you started playing the piano. And I learned that very quickly. So I started taking lessons around then, and I enjoyed it a lot. And I also it was called Piano Adventures, the Fabers, I think. They had these little music theory books, and so I just liked doing them. They were sort of like times tables, and I liked doing those. So I kind of got into some version of music theory at some point in there, and then I continued to like it in high school, where we had like theory, AP theory class and stuff like that. And then I went into piano performance at the University of Georgia. And I still liked playing piano a lot then, but I think I much more enjoyed, and I think like Owen was better at, I think, music theory than the piano side of things. Though my vision of what music theory was in undergrad, I think, was not entirely accurate. I really just liked throwing Roman numerals on stuff, doing little part writing exercises, you know, analyzing pieces, but again, in a very limited kind of objective way. And it that brought me a lot of satisfaction. And I was, you know, had some idea that there was like a more humanistic side of things out there. I took, I think, one class where we read one theory article at some point. But there wasn't much of a theory faculty at UGA at that time. And I think it's fortunately changed now. So I ended up applying to several schools and got into the University of Colorado in Boulder for my master's. And I really was exposed to what theory was. And fortunately, I liked that side of things. So the more humanistic angle, the writing and the scholarship, And then I continued on to my PhD at Eastman, where to reiterate what everyone said, I also met Owen and Katrina. So.
Great. Well, thank you all for sharing. So let's go ahead and get into your time at Eastman. We can circle back to Katrina now. So tell me about your time at Eastman and what you liked and the research that you got into your dissertation.
Sure. Yeah. Oh my gosh. At this point, it's been kind of a while since we were there. I don't want to say how long, but it has been a little bit since we've been at Eastman. Yeah, go ahead.
You're the youngest of all of us.
Yeah, but we were there for the same, we entered at the same time. We entered at the same time, but I actually, so I did not have a master's. So I had an extra, like one more year of coursework. I'm just going to say the date. It was 2013. That's when we started at Eastman. And I'm saying that because if anything I say might be quite different from it is like from now, which is, I guess, 10 years later. And I don't want to give a false impression about how the program is now and how it's structured, because I know there's a lot of new faculty that have been hired in the last few years. So my experience is probably not going to be the same as anyone that I was, with at the same time, even, and certainly not today. I enjoyed my time at Eastman. I think we got some pretty rigorous training in analysis, and that's kind of what I knew something about what theory looked like as a discipline going into the program there, but certainly not. I didn't have a very panoptic, like a very full sense of the scale of it or what kinds of what the discipline looked like, or certainly not its history. And I feel like I got a better sense of that while I was there. And while I took like history of theory classes with Bob Wasson and Henry Klumpenhauer, I found that really interesting and fascinating. While theory classes took up like the majority of the requirements, I was able to also take an intro to musicology class with Holly Watkins while I was there. And I thought that was just really one of my favorite classes. I did that kind of later in my coursework after getting some of the earlier things out of the way. And Eastman also has a very strong teaching focus. And I think that that is something that was really helpful going into, once we had graduated, or in my case, once I was ABD and taught for a couple of years while I was sort of writing my dissertation, kind of, while also teaching at 1 year stints at other places. So it was a rigorous program. It was difficult. I got a lot of skills in terms of, I think, both in like research and teaching. And I think that, it kind of gave me a sort of advantage apart from, of course, just the name of Eastman, which is, I think, helpful on the job market. I don't know if that's fully what you were looking for, Lydia, though. So can I answer anything more specific, maybe?
Yes. Also, so what did you do your dissertation on?
Oh, yes. Thank you. Okay. my dissertation is on the romantic introduction, and it focuses on unusual introductions in the music of a few early romantic composers, late classical early romantic composers. Mostly Beethoven and Felix Mendelssohn and a bit of Fanny Hensel. And then that Fanny Hensel work is kind of what drove a lot of my research after finishing my PhD, just kind of getting more into her music. So that's kind of been more of what my research program has looked like since leaving grad school.
Okay, great. Thank you for sharing. Sounds fascinating. All right, Owen, tell us about your time at Eastman. Spill all the gritty details. We can cut it out.
Just snowy. I mean, it wasn't particularly gritty, I don't think. So as Katrina said, we entered fall 2013. And so I did have a master's, so I guess it was one less year of coursework, but it took me 5 years so I graduated in 2018. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, I'm not sure I have too much to add to what Katrina said. I thought it was what I wanted, I think, out of a theory program. I mean, I wanted it to be hard. And when you get Bob Wasson's History of Theory reading list, and it's like, read these three treatises in a week, it's like, oh yeah, this is exactly what I thought this would be like. I remember being kind of intimidated at the beginning. I mean, I had heard of Eastman, and it took me a little bit to figure out kind of if I fitted in there and kind of belonged. When you walk in the front doors, there are these sort of pictures of all these faculty that have been there since the early, you know, it's imposing. But I certainly really enjoy my time there. I met my wife there. So it was a good experience for me. I wrote my dissertation under Henry Klumpenhauer, who was, you know, I was initially interested in transformational theory, and he's a pretty significant name in that area. So I had read some of his articles, and I just thought it was fantastic when he moved to Eastman, and I was really excited to study with him. My dissertation wound up having almost nothing to do with that. It was on developing a model for kind of a responsible hermeneutics of Bach cantatas, which I really haven't done much with, but the kind of the undergirding philosophy about analysis is what I've really since then. So the actual material I've abandoned, and I'm not sure if I'll come back to it or not, just because I'm not sure. I think maybe after spending a couple of years with it, I was just tired of it. But it was great to work with Henry, and kind of the motivating ideas, I think, are what I'm still interested in.
Okay, great. Thank you for this. All sounds so fascinating. Now I'm like, oh, I have to have you all on separately to like talk more about your research. Okay, let's hear from Alan.
So I agree with a lot of what Katrina and Owen have said. And I also felt, I think, that sense of intimidation that Owen was talking about. And I think this is what a lot of people feel when they join graduate programs, that like you're the idiot that got through or you know, something like that, or at least that was my feeling. And you know, obviously compared to people who got there before you, but also the people in your group. And you know, people are name dropping a lot of times, you know, like, God, I don't know that name. And it can feel very, very intimidating. But I will say one thing about Eastman that was really nice is there was a lot of camaraderie amongst the grad students. I think one reason that was possible is because there was this one gigantic TA office that we would just all be in all the time. And so it was a really great way to get to know people and to socialize and stuff. And that made, you know, the heavy workloads and things like that a lot more feasible. You could, you know, complain about it together, which is really nice. In my dissertation topic, I also worked with Henry Klumpenhauer. I was also, you know, really into kind of transformational theory kinds of stuff. And I ended up writing on the Polish composer Karl Szymanowski. The only reason I really did was because in my master's, when I was at Colorado, I had to write a master's thesis, and my advisor there, Keith Waters, just threw out Szymanowski. I'd never heard of him, listened to his music. I liked it, tried to analyze it, failed immediately, and did something else. And so then I just kind of kept coming back to his stuff in, you know, for like seminar papers and stuff while I was at Eastman, and just kind of, initially, I don't know if it was driven by like the best of reasons, but I ended up really liking his music and really trying to develop various kinds of, you know, analytical gizmos and stuff to approach his sort of World War I era music. And so, yeah, my dissertation is just sort of a collection of different approaches to different pieces. And I've, you know, done some of that, you know, turned some of that into publication, but I think also kind of like, oh, and I'm sort of moving on, I think, from that as well. But I definitely enjoyed working on that project.
I will say, maybe this was not the same for you, Alan, but I had about, I think I chose, like the decision for my dissertation topic was, I felt maybe like 62% mine. And like 48%, it was like, oh, you should work on this. And I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah, I think that was part of it. I mean, I worked on it as an independent study, and you kind of feel like, well, I'm on the rails and I need to get out of here, right? Yes. So, you know, you're not going to just, you already did some work, right? So you're going to just kind of continue on with that project. And of course, again, I enjoyed it. I got a lot out of it. But, you know, after you accomplish that, you're like, I don't want to see this writing again. I don't want to read these typos. I found so many typos since then. But anyway, please don't read my dissertation. I just want to let people know this. Don't
PSA,
do that. Please.
Don't read yeah. Alan's dissertation. No, I mean,
nobody was tempted, Alan.
Listeners, you can look in the show notes and find the link to Alan's dissertation, but don't click it. So, so I mean, but that's a good point that also like your tastes and your interests shift after you leave. Like it's a whole phase of life. And once you get further on in your career, you probably will be, right? Meet other people, especially outside of the discipline of music, be more exposed to theories and methodologies that you find really interesting. And so it's only natural that, you know, as you kind of progress, the things that you're interested in shift and change, and what you're researching now might not be the same in 10 years and, you know, all that stuff. So it seems natural to me. I also think, you know, to echo kind of that feeling of entering grad school and being like, I don't know what's going on here. I definitely, because my background is I have two performance degrees. They're both in vocal performance. I'm a classical soprano and I do opera. And so, you know, the listeners know and are well aware, because I started this degree or this podcast while I was finishing my master's degree at Roosevelt University in Chicago. Shout out Katrina. And, you know, as I was finishing up and I graduated with my master's in 2021. So peak pandemic times, right? Like there and panicking, right? I don't have another plan. I don't know what I'm going to do. And that's when some of my academic professors were, you know, whispering in my ear about, well, you write some good papers. Have you ever thought about music theory? You did really well in the, you know, music theory review course. Like, have you thought about? And I was like, no, that sounds weird. I don't know. But I didn't have another
weird
plan.
your instincts were on point.
It's weird.
And they were right. You know, yes, it is weird, and continues to be. But, you know, they could kind of see in me that I was interested in engaging with music in more than one way. So, you know, and it worked out. I upon arriving, I did have my first year of utter confusion in terms of like, what is this? What is this field? What am I supposed to be doing here? I have to read for like kind of the first time, like academic prose and all that stuff. So I definitely went through my own phase of like, I don't really know what this is and I don't know what I'm doing here. And it seems like everybody knows what's going on except for me. I'm happy to report I'm now 2 years in to the 5-year degree and I haven't dropped out. So I like it. But I'm glad to hear that you all experienced a sense of camaraderie while you were there and that your relationships have continued after you've all graduated. So thank you so much for sharing that. Before we move on to talking about the MTO article, I would love to hear, we'll go around one more time, you know, for my own learning as I'm going through the process of this degree, I would love to know kind of looking back on your time at Eastman as a grad student and what you've experienced since then, if you have one piece of advice to give me or other grad students that are listening to the show, anything related to reading for the first time, researching for the first time, and figuring out what you want to do your dissertation on, you know, Owen already alluded to perhaps not being being influenced in terms of what you pick, which isn't necessarily bad, but any advice you have in relation to picking a dissertation topic, writing for the first time, and learning how to write in an academic style, or teaching for the first time. The listeners know from listening to this podcast, this first year of teaching for me was, you know, we made it. And my students seem to be doing okay, but that was a definite difficult experience for me. And so any piece of advice related to those things?
Things that seem like a really big deal will not be.
Expand on that.
Well, I just remember being very anxious about every little hoop you had to jump through. And wanting to, I don't know. I think I could have been, and this is just the way I approach life in general, so it maybe doesn't have anything to do with anyone else or academia, but I could have stressed less. And
that is so interesting, knowing that all of this degree is, it's 5 years of stress.
Well, it is, but I mean, we were, I think all three of us were lucky enough to have some pretty good funding at Eastman. So, you know, we were really being more or less paid to read, which is a great life. There's way worse ways to spend your time. So I think I could have worried a little bit less about the next thing and just taking it day by day. I mean, you know, you hear about the difficulty of the dissertation or the difficulty of the job market, and you can spend a lot of time pre-worrying that when you're really not, it's not really time to worry about that, right? I mean, it's time to finish this one seminar or to prep class for the next day. So I think I borrowed some gray hairs. But again, I do that with everything. DMV, doesn't matter.
No, that's really helpful. That is really helpful, because you also just see me studying for these comps. Oh, that was...
Well, now that is real. So that anxiety... No, I'm just kidding. But that was, yeah, I mean, that was certainly a very high sort of stressful situation, but
I see what you're saying about, like, not getting ahead of yourself, because I do think it is easy to prematurely worry about the job market or prematurely worry about, you know, instead of focusing on what's in front of you and being present for where you're at in the process. I think that is helpful.
Yeah, I think that's a much better way of saying what I meant to say.
Terrible work, Owen. I'm just kidding.
That's what I'm known for.
No, actually, that kind of sparked something. So for me, so it was really helpful to hear you say that, actually. And I, like, because I also am thinking that there were things that I worried about in grad school that were not, that were just destructive, as opposed to, and it's not to say that they're not legitimate. Like, you know, the fear and anxiety that you have in graduate school is existential. It is absolutely real, and it's grounded in reality. And there's nothing irrational about it. I think one thing that I feel like I could have done better was to, maybe not done better, that's not the right word for it. I think one thing that would have been helpful to realize in grad school is that I think I worried a lot unconsciously about sunk cost and how much time and energy I had put into getting to where I was while I was at Eastman, and that doing something different or doing things not the way that the program maybe expected or assumed me to act. I think I spent too much time thinking about what I was supposed to be doing as opposed and how much I would lose by not doing that, as opposed to what really made me passionate and what excited me and was in keeping with my core values. Because that's not really much. I wouldn't say that my values have changed much since, like, in my adult life. And I think, I don't want to assume, but I think that's often true for people. I think, I don't know if that, maybe that sounds too, that's too abstract.
I think that's I think that's a good way to put it. I mean, you get especially, like, maybe this is not what you meant, but like you get to the end of the program and it's like, well, I'm nearing 30, or at least I was. I've been in school doing this for a long, long time. You know, my friends from college are already like mid-career now. If I change and do something else, I've wasted a decade. You know, it's that's kind of in the back of your mind, you know, like if so every failure or possible failure is amplified.
I think that's really great. Like, just, I would say, like, to any graduate student, the time you've put in is not wasted. You can your skills have prepared you to do more than just this. And it is not a failure, a failure of yourself or an existential failure to change gears and do something else. It's not really ever too late, is what I would want to say. And maybe I think that openness to possibility and the seeing like the fullness of person that you are is really important to do, instead of trying to think about what you're supposed to do and what a theorist is or what a music scholar is.
No, absolutely. Especially because, you know, this is such an all-consuming career and identity, both the identity of musician and the identity of academic, and learning to see yourself, the multiplicity of self, the fullness of self that you're talking about, helps prevent you from experiencing any career failure as like a moral failure, right? That you're like a failure of a person. I know, again, speaking to job market anxiety, and if you don't get a job right after you finish, or you don't get the job, or you end up, you know, adjuncting for a while or leaving academia altogether, and it is easy to look back at that time and see it as a waste, because academia formally only kind of trains you to be in academia. But as you're saying, looking at like you during a degree like this, you grow in so many more ways than you anticipate. And all of that growth can be put towards whatever your next thing is, whatever you decide for it to be. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, and I would just add that, and this is sort of, I guess, connects in some ways to what some of the stuff we say in the article, but so much of how we view education is that we are being trained to do this, that it is job training, that it is like, we are being trained to do this one thing. And if we are failing at that, like that's, you know, if you fail at that, you fail in the marketplace of academia, like your value is less, right? Because that's how we're trained to kind of perceive of who is valued and what is valued. That's what I would say. Like, I mean, those feelings are real, but also, you know, I don't think it has to be that way, I guess. You know, that's not how we have to determine value.
All right, so that is going to do it for this episode of the podcast. Like I mentioned before, this is only part one of our conversation, so stay tuned for part two. And make sure you check the show notes for the link to their article and any other scholarship that we mention. If you like this episode and you want to let me know, if you have feedback about other episodes, if you have suggestions for what I should be listening to or reading or checking out for the show, or if you want to be a guest on the show yourself, please send me an email at hermusicacademia@gmail.com. Or go to my website, hermusicacademia.com, fill out the contact form there, get in touch with me, and tell me what you do in music. Until next time, thanks for listening.